You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday, the 10th of December, 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, it's Tuesday, which means we are going to continue our Eyewitness to History series with our veteran nationalist, Mr. I. Mr. I, hello to you, sir. How are you doing? Welcome to the show.
Very well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. And I hear you want to talk about the home front during the Second World War today. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. As one of a diminishing number of people who have a clear recollection of the 3rd of September 1939, I can tell you that the feeling amongst the population, well, the feelings amongst the populations were one of apprehension and disbelief. Apprehension because Mr. Stanley Baldwin, when Prime Minister, had told us that the bomber will always get through, as indeed it did, and disbelief because at the 1935 general election, the coalition government was returned with a large majority under the slogan, Peace in Our Time. Now, unfortunately, things were going on in Parliament. And of course, I have mentioned in a previous talk how Churchill was able to wheedle his way back into the cabinet, first as First Lord of the Admiralty, and then eventually as Prime Minister, and how he appointed himself Defence Minister with dictatorial powers. Now, the first thing he did was prolong the life of Parliament and cancel the election that was due in 1940. So that gave him a clear hand as to what he could do. With the notorious Regulation 18B, and he added an amendment to it that saying that giving the Home Secretary the powers to detain without charge, trial or term set anyone with whom he had reasonable cause to believe were sympathetic to Germany. Now, in the Magna Carta, it also says to no one will we deny or delay justice. That in the American Embassy, there was a chap called Tyler Kent, who was known to have communist sympathies, and he was also friendly with the daughter of a Russian aristocrat who had been dispossessed and expelled from Russia by the communists. Her name was Anna Wolkoff. And it was believed that she had sympathies for Germany, which is she's most likely to have had. Now, Tyler Kent, as I mentioned, was a cipher clerk in the American embassy, and he was intercepting calls that Roosevelt was making to Churchill behind Chamberlain's back. And of course, if that had been known, it's most unlikely that Roosevelt would have been elected to a third term, which was a record third term in office. So something had to be done about him. And his trial was suspended until the American election, in which Roosevelt was returned. Because the information that he had would have most certainly meant that Roosevelt would not have been elected. And of course, as soon as he was, he immediately broke the American laws on neutrality by passing the Lease-Lend Act, which sent war material to Britain. Now, how that affected us on the home front was that there were clauses in the Lease-Lend Act that anything they sent us must be used for purposes of pursuing the war. We were not to use anything to continue the manufacture of goods that we could export, which meant to say that we couldn't manufacture things such as motor cars, which meant that at the end of the war, when we were desperately trying to get our export market back, the car we were trying to export was in fact the 1940 model. And of course that gave our competitors in Germany and Japan an edge on us, because they had continued the production of motor cars. And that's another awkward thing, that people didn't really appreciate. Anyway, back to the early war years, there was the rationing system for food was very fair, because it meant that everybody had a sufficient diet, and prices were controlled. So there was no hoarding or anything like that in the hope of getting a higher price. But there was a problem with non-rationed goods. It had a rather odd effect that all of a sudden you couldn't buy razor blades, things like that, anywhere. great shortages, and the problem was that the government hadn't given any rules and regulations about non-Russian goods. But oddly, the thing that made them do something about it was the shortage of ladies' sanitary articles. And then there was such an uproar about that, and they eventually had to start imposing some control on non-Russian goods. And of course, the first few months of the war were called the phony war, because apart from U-boats torpedoing our ships, there was very little activity, or almost no activity in the air. Although a few, for example, on the second day of the war, we sent a force of the newly produced Wellington bombers to bomb naval targets at Brunsbüttel at the mouth of the canal. And there's a little bit interesting in that for your listeners. Several of the RAF planes were shot down, and among the casualties were two members of the British Union, the fascists. One chap's name was Brocking, and the other chap's name was Day. Two members of the British Union of fascists who lost their lives fighting for the country on the first day of the war. This, of course, belied the fact that any of them would behave as traitors. Then, of course, the first few months of the war were called the phony war. But the moment the Germans struck at France and defeated the French army, leaving us to make its way as best they could back to England, completely disorganised. But a strange thing about that was Hitler had got such a fine regard for the fighting qualities of the British Tommy, having met with them on the Western Front in the First World War, that he couldn't believe that we were in full retreat. And he warned that they were probably, von Kleist, who was the German commander attacking the British Expeditionary Force, that they were probably regrouping with the view to making a counterattack, which, of course, had they done so, that would have jeopardised the main thrust that was directed at Paris. they're completely disorganised. They've abandoned their equipment. They're making for the coastal towns, and they're being evacuated by sailing ships and those yachts and things like that. But, and it's interesting that Basil, what was his name, the historian, in his account of the Battle of France, he headed a chapter on how Hitler defeated France and saved Britain. Yeah. And because then nothing much happened for a while after Dunkirk, but eventually Hitler, he'd made these overtures of peace, but on the 1st of July, he made what he called his appeal to reason, and he said he sees no reason why the war should continue, and offered us the same terms that he gave to France, and which they accepted. That was peace with honour, with our people safe, and our navy and our empire intact. But, of course, unfortunately, Churchill had become Prime Minister and Ward, as I mentioned earlier, and with the help of Roosevelt, was able to continue the war. On the 22nd of August 1940, he was told by Sir Kingsley that we alone hadn't the resources to continue the war. And so he placed our future completely in the hands of Roosevelt then, and the war continued. And it's very unfortunate that the very next day, on the 23rd, there was a daylight bombing raid on the small town where I lived in the south of England at the time, which killed 36 people, including a school chum of mine, a chap called Archie Bursley, who was a fine athlete. He was the school boys' champion for the 220 and 440 yards race, and he was also a well-known Boy Scout for his activities. The first casualty I saw from that raid was actually a soldier. There were five of them killed in the raid. They were walking down the high street, or station road it was, and on their way to the cinema. Five of them on evening leave, and they were all killed. And as I went down the road to see what had happened, there was a huge plume of smoke where builder's yard was on fire and all the pots of paint were burning, and made an awful smell and smoke. And there were two ashen-faced auxiliary firemen carrying this soldier's body to the fire station where they'd they used to lay the casualties out on the floor for identification. And they stumbled going over a paving stone, and the soldier's leg came over the side of the stretcher, and I had to help them put his leg back on there and tuck it in so that his heel was on the inside of the stretcher. That's a strange experience. When you think, I was only 12 years old at the time. You know, that's quite an experience for a boy. And that is where, as I say, the casualties were laid out on the fire station floor. The fire station, the fire engines themselves always being out, of course, on duty. And then there was another time when I went in the the garden, because there was our front gate wouldn't shut properly. So I was walking down by the side of the house to get the front door. I looked up, and there was a hike of 111 door just across the coast, and was overhead. It's just an amazing thing. You know, there's the enemy, and he might kill me. it flew over without incident, and then it turned a little bit to starboard and proceeded obviously in the direction of Southampton, and then another one came over and followed the same route, and then all of a sudden they'd been spotted and anti-aircraft shells were bursting around them. Maybe that's the time to get undercover, because it's surprising how far the shrapnel from a shell exploding in mid-air can fly. So that was another slightly alarming experience. And then the only time I actually heard bombs whistling down was one night when, of course, when the big raids were on the air raid warning was on practically all, you know, from dawn to dusk, from dusk to dawn, rather the other way around it, wasn't it? Dusk to dawn. And one night I heard bombs actually whistling down, and they fell in a field. The four of them fell in a field at the bottom of our garden. And of course, no damage at all. When a bomb dropped, an aimed bomb is dropped like that onto soft earth, about 90% of the force of the explosion is absorbed by the soft ground, where they blow the great big crater. And they overcame that problem by dropping what they called landmines. That was bombs on parachutes that went off with a proximity fuse, when it was near the ground. And of course, the full blast was then affected all the area around it. And another thing they used to drop were a crude form of napalm, which they use now. And it was a thick, oily substance in a bomb. And the idea was that the bomb would explode on impact and throw all this tarry oil stuff, and which would then ignite. But I did see one when I was visiting Southampton one day, in Portswood Road, there where one had exploded, but the tarry oil hadn't ignited. You could see the mess. Oh, this poor woman with her house all for the front of it covered with this sticky mass of oil. God, yeah. And another thing was when incendiary bombs fell in the road, and the Southampton had a tram line system, and the lines were embedded in wooden blocks that were set with pitch, and when that caught fire, it was an awful job to put out. I can remember seeing the firemen spraying the hoses like that. The flame would go out, and the moment water had passed, it would catch light again. Because it was burning the pitch and these wooden blocks deep, 2 or 3 feet down into the road. I did mention in a previous talk about the flares I used to drop on lovely silk parachutes, little parachutes, and the souvenirs of any aircraft came down, whether it was one of theirs or one of theirs, all the local boys used to somehow first on the scene, helping themselves to great big belts of ammunition and all sorts of things like a pitch. Much to the concern of the police and the army and the air force. I remember in school one day, there was a sudden burst of machine gun fire, and it was a Hurricane firing at a Junkers 88, which crashed at a place called Wardle Cliff. I remember the bits and pieces of it that were scattered a long way apart. And all the crew were killed. And they were laid out on the fire station floor. And some people used to go in there with the intention of, you know, kicking them or spitting on them. But as soon as they saw them, especially as there's one chap just 18 years old, you know, they were overcome with pity, which was a good thing in a way, you know, to realise how terrible war is, affecting friends and foes alike. Now, I can remember there were actually the officer in charge of the pilot was a lieutenant. There were two UNCA officers. Air equivalent would be flight sergeants. And this aircraftsman, a flieger, the young chap, a flieger, a flyer.
We're very lucky that you survived it all. It seems like you had quite a few sort of close shaves there with the bombs going off. But I have got a question, Mr. I, with Tyler Kent, and he was recording Churchill talking to Roosevelt, and you said that if that had come out, that would have cost Roosevelt his election. What was it that was actually recorded? What was it that would have cost him the election? What naughty things did he manage to record?
Well, he was he was talking to Churchill behind Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's back, and of course it was a conspiracy to get America in the war on our side. Because it's pretty obvious, as I may have mentioned in an earlier talk, that France had been defeated. We'd lost lots and lots of equipment and that at Dunkirk. And of course, in the Far East, Japan was making threatening noises. And Italy had joined in the war against us. So it's obvious we couldn't have continued as Sir Kingsley Wood, the Chancellor, had told us. that we haven't the resources to continue the war. So the only thing from Churchill's point of view was to try and get the Americans in the war. Of course, Roosevelt was making promises that I'm not going to get send our boys to war and things like that, he would say. Of course, all the time he was conspiring to do just that.
Amazing. It's amazing, isn't it? You know, the duplicity involved.
So his association with Anna Wolkoff, as I mentioned, she was the daughter of a Russian aristocrat who'd lost everything and had to flee Russia with the Communist Revolution. And she had contacts with other Russian emigres that went to Germany. So they were a bit suspicious about her activities. But even so, that doesn't detract from the fact that we denied Tyler Kent his rights to an immediate trial just because of what was going on between Churchill and Roosevelt.
Amazing. That's really amazing stuff there, Mr. I. That's... yeah, all these talks are fantastic. There's so much information there that I was unaware of before, and I'm sure most of our listeners are unaware of as well. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Carolyn Jaeger. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.